Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I hope that gave you enough time to have a bit of a shake off and grab a cuppa. I think we're going to get going again. And it gives me great pleasure now to introduce our next speaker, who is Rhianne Williams. Now, Rhianne is a dispute systems design practitioner whose work focuses on supporting governments and others to transition from adversarial to collaborative dispute resolution mechanisms. Her work centres on projects that extend the capacity of individuals and communities in creating partnerships to support dialogue and mutual problem solving. So she's particularly skilled in working in highly diverse contexts, ranging from remote Indigenous communities through to senior executives in the Australian public service and business, and in developing programs that support those engaged in complex, challenging and changing environments. And way back at the beginning of the WCC, after we had our very first inaugural meetings, another very good friend and colleague of mine in Canberra who's been involved with the ANU Dialogue Group called David Purnell said to me, well, you must speak to Rhianne Williams. So I got on to Rhianne and she, as I mentioned earlier, she helped us develop our proposal and has been in constant back and forth conversations with us. So Rhianne, over to you.
Thank you, Janet. Just checking that everyone can hear me. So thumbs up if you can, that would be great. Fabulous. I'd like to start first off by acknowledging the welcome by Matilda House and acknowledge the Ngambri and Ngunnawal people on whose country I am here today. I'd also like to acknowledge the First Nations sovereignty of people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people throughout Australia, which has never been ceded. And I would like to acknowledge that sovereignty is continuing. I've also enjoyed listening to the presentation so much this morning, and one of the things that some of you may have heard was the conversation that happened briefly just before we came back, where I think Margaret was asking a question about the fact that the people that are on the same side lobbying for climate change don't get together to work out their shared position. And one of the things that I want to say is that what we've heard from the speakers this morning is that, in fact, part of actually being able to participate in processes is actually that preparation work. And where groups are on the same side, actually building coalitions of agreement, that indicates, particularly to politicians, the vast groundswell. And there's power in actually 15 groups and their supporters being represented in a meeting rather than 15 groups meeting separately. So I think hopefully that will emerge from this presentation today. I want to take you back to the Challenger disaster, which was, I think, in 1986, which is probably for a number of you who are watching, possibly long before you were born. But for others, it's probably something that you may remember. One of the things that was terrible about that, it was the first disaster of a space shuttle and everyone on board was killed. The interesting thing that emerged, and Dr. Philip Zimbardo, who wrote an amazing book called The Lucifer Effect, who some of you might know as being the architect of the Stanford Prison Experiment, which looks at how groups function, explored the fact that it was actually a simple O-ring, which costs about 50 cents, two O-rings that were actually redundant, failed. And the mechanics had actually been talking and saying, trying to get the rocket scientists to listen to them, but the rocket scientists wouldn't listen. And so consequently, it led to this terrible disaster. One of the things that I guess is really important in terms of reflecting about the importance of process is that the solutions that we need will come from listening to the wisdoms of everyone. And when we start weaving those solutions, things will emerge that we cannot currently see. So at the beginning of lockdown, just before lockdown happened in 2020, I did a knitting course. And I spent most of my lockdown trying to knit a scarf, which took me a very long time because I was a very inexperienced knitter. But the interesting thing about it was that because I would drop it off at a friend when I made terrible mistakes and she would fix it for me. And I think the thing about weaving is that we become expert at what we do, and that's what we think we always need to do. But what we've heard from the speakers this morning is that if we have the same systems, they will deliver us the same solutions. And they are the same systems that have delivered us the problems that we're in. So part of what we need to be thinking about are different ways of working. And as has been spoken about extensively this morning, that really involves deep listening. And the moment we start deep listening, and I in particular want to thank those of you who've been listening since 10 o'clock this morning, because I'm asking you to listen to me, and you've done a lot of listening so far this morning. What's more important is you've heard people speak, but the wisdom that we need to hear from is your wisdom, because your wisdom will take this forward. And so I'm really keen to hear what will emerge from the conversations we have after I finish speaking. We need processes. We need new processes to make things change. And one of my favorite examples that I've been traveling with as telling stories about for a long time is in the late 90s, scientists were aware that there was a very bad El Nino effect likely to be hitting a number of nations in the South Pacific. And what they needed to do is actually let communities know what was going on. And one of the things that they would often do, they'd be standing in under sheds, tin roof, pouring rain, and telling people, this is probably going to be the last rain that you're going to get. And interestingly enough, even though that El Nino impact was one of the most severe that had been known, the impacts actually in communities were amongst the least severe. And the reason for that was because the scientists had worked in collaboration with people in the community. And as one of the scientists said in describing it, he said, you can't just put this in a paper and expect people to believe it. It's got to be eyeball to eyeball contact. So that building of relationship and trust, and that sense of, this information is information we can trust, and because I know you and because you know me and because we have this relationship of trust, we can work together. And so what we need actually in relation to climate change are processes, and as we've heard from the speakers already, so the Christina in talking about the Conservatives for Climate Change, recognizing that when information is being presented, what you need to do is actually present information from scientific experts or from other experts that Conservatives will have trust in. And there are a number of those experts who are out there. And what you're doing is elevating those voices that are actually rational and reasonable in relation to climate change, because people are more likely to trust people that they have an understanding of. We need to find the experts across the political divide who actually are speaking the same thing. And last night, for example, when I was driving home, I heard two economists, Richard Dennis from the Australia Institute and Janet, and I'm at this point, I can't remember Janet's surname, who is a writer with the Australian, and both of them, one's quite left and one's quite right, but they were both analysing the economic situation that we're in using very similar models and sharing the same sorts of concerns. So much of the conflict that we experience about this is because the loud, shouty people are the ones that get elevated. And part of what we need to do is work out how do we bring back that, in fact, those loud, shouty people are important, but the vast majority of people are listening and don't have the opportunity to actually speak. Traditional processes will not deliver the outcomes that we need. So we need different types of processes. So what do traditional processes look like? There's a fabulous book by a woman by the name of Susan Carpenter, who's written a book called Managing Public Policy Disputes. And she describes what she calls the Solomon's Trap. So the Solomon's Trap is the standard consultation process. We've all been there. You know, just before Christmas, a government will release a major paper that they want a consultation. Community consultation is really important. It's a three-week window, mostly while people are off on Christmas holidays. What then happens is all that information, and sometimes it doesn't just happen at Christmas, it happens at other times of the year as well. But often what happens is there's a limited window, and people provide their input to government. Certain groups, perhaps because they have greater economic influence, might get to meet with government or whoever is running that consultation process. All of that information is fed into one central point. But what that means is that the people who are feeding in that information never get to hear the information from other people. Whoever is in the center, that person or those people are the ones that actually if you like, become the repository of all the information. I've realized, by the way, that I talk a lot with my hands, which don't necessarily work that well on screen, but we'll leave that as it is. The interesting thing then that will happen is that people will, the person running the consultation process will then release their recommendation as to what should be done. When they do that, what then tends to happen is all of the groups attack that decision because it doesn't reflect what they see as being what's needed. Because all they have seen is actually their own information being fed in. There's not been an opportunity to hear anyone else's information, which when we hear other people's perspectives, moderates and mediates how we understand problems. And what Susan Carpenter would say is that that is the classic consultation process, and that is the process that is pretty standard out there for decision making. If we think about climate change, what we have is government as the central point trying to mediate, if you like, between the competing interests of conservatives, people concerned about the environment, people concerned about jobs, and so on. But those groups are not actually brought into conversation with each other. And in fact, as a result of being brought into conversation with each other, which Susan Carpenter describes as a different approach, which she calls a sequence for communal decision making, that means that there's an accountability. So if you're wanting to cut jobs to protect the environment, or you're wanting to protect the environment and you're not concerned about jobs, one of the things you need to look at is it isn't that those needs and interests are necessarily in competition with one another. It's that both those things matter, and how do you make both of them central to your particular perspective of solving the problem that you need to solve. So, for example, what that means is, and I've written this down, the weaving, if you like, in the Solomon's trap process, where the government makes the decision, they choose the threads. That is, they choose who gets spoken to. They choose the pattern. That is, they choose what gets elevated in the report. And they also then choose the final product. So they choose what gets recommended. So we have that one central decision-making point, that one point, as being the thing from which everything radiates. But in a sequence that actually brings the stakeholders together, and that this is what we're talking about in relation to that macro level decision making, that's a different approach. So what it does is it recognizes the importance of government as the convener of a process, but not the director or the leader of the process, and not the director and the determiner of what will emerge from that. The stakeholders are actually brought into relationship with each other, and they share the information with each other. And this means, instead of only one central point hearing all that information is heard by everyone, which means that then the weaving, if you like, is done by all of the stakeholders involved. All are working together to choose to listen to the voices, that everyone gets to hear what's being said. All those threads are being drawn together by each stakeholder who's participating. They're all working together to develop the pattern. So suddenly I was just concerned about species extinction, but actually I now understand that if you lose your job, then in fact that's going to have a critical impact in terms of, you might then, I have an obligation to think about, my job's protected as a result of species protection, yours is not. You have a right to have a job. You don't necessarily have a right to do a particular type of job, but you have a right to have access to meaningful employment that allows you to support yourself. Suddenly your interests and concerns become my interests and concerns, and my interests and concerns become your interests and concerns as well. And what that means is that the final product is recommended by all of the stakeholders. The answers, if you like, are woven together by all of the stakeholders. Now, does this sound like it's pie in the sky? It's not. It's the Micronesian example. So it's the story of the scientists working with the people in the South Pacific to mitigate the impacts of climate change. It is that idea of bringing people together to share the problem and to work out the solutions that makes the difference. But I'm going to give you another example from a piece of work I've done. And please excuse me, I'm just going to check my timer because I know we're really tight for time today and I don't want to talk over, which I have a tendency to do. The example that I'm going to share is several years ago, a colleague and I were invited to facilitate a process that was looking at developing research responses to otitis media in Aboriginal communities. So hearing loss for Aboriginal children is a phenomenal tragedy in this country. Up to 70 to 90% of Aboriginal kids, particularly in remote locations, will have middle ear infection at any one time. The only kids who approach that, non-Indigenous kids, are kids in childcare, but the rate sits between 10 to 15%. The process that we actually developed, one of the things that we brought together, educationalists, audiologists, ear, nose and throats, surgeons, researchers, Aboriginal health practitioners and others to work out what could be done. When we were framing the process, the National Health and Medical Research Council and the Office of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Services said to us, there's so many people coming, and I think there are about 40 people coming. They're like, there's only time to have three people introduce themselves. And my colleague and I, my colleague is an Indigenous person, we were like, if you only have three people speaking, who will you have speak? Whoever's voices you privilege, you are setting the norm that those are the only people whose voices and stories and accounts matter. So we fought really hard in the beginning of the process to ensure that there was a process where everybody was introduced. And one of the things that emerged from that was amazing things emerged from that process. So as a result of that, there was a point where ear, nose and throat surgeons, of which there were three at the time that serviced the top third of Australia, their advice to government was, wait until a child is 14, stick a grommet in their ear and the problem is solved. But if you wait until a child is 14 before you put a grommet in the ear, because developmentally it stopped developing, In fact, if that child has had hearing loss before the age of one, that child has had 14 years of language, social, and cultural developmental delay that can't be caught up on. We tend to see the solutions in terms of the expertise that we have. So when we broaden the group out, we suddenly realize that in fact, our solutions are not necessarily addressing the problem. So the reason we need processes that weave together the different understandings and the different wisdoms is because in fact, we all know that we need to address climate change. Even the people I would suggest who will say, no, climate change doesn't exist or whatever, in their heart of hearts, I suspect they know. Because we can look around us and see the ways in which the weather and the climate is changing and the impacts that that's having. But one of the things that we're reluctant to do is work out, well, this is the answer. This is what I think the solution should be. We think we need to know the answers. But what I would say at this point in time is because we have not listened to the wisdoms of everyone, we don't know what the answers are. And we don't need to know the answers. We need to trust that process will get us to the right answer. I'm realizing I have a very limited amount of time left. So what I'm going to do is actually summarize what I have taken from the speakers who've spoken before and then finish with one last story. So the thing that came through really clearly for me in terms of listening to Janet and Karen and Christina and Loran and Alex and Kirsten was the overlaps between what they were saying. That fundamentally what we need is deep listening, which is what we have asked you to do this morning. So thank you for doing that work of deep listening. It is the most important work. But interestingly enough, it's the work that is often least valued. We need to recognize that the same systems will deliver the same outcomes. So if we're going to do things differently, we need different systems. And I loved Christina's point about bringing conservatives is recognizes that conservation has its very roots conservatism. So we need to find ways of reflecting this story to people so that they can see a way of buying into it. The other thing is that we need to work separately. So Christina and Kirsten both talked about that we need to work at that micro level, preparing people to be in conversation with other groups, particularly where they might see their interests as being at odds with those other groups. But fundamentally, we need processes where people have prepared separately, where in fact they're then brought into a macro process that allows them to build relationships and to weave connections across that divide. We need to create safe spaces and to create connections that support deep listening. And that means we need to be brave. So I think one of the things that was said by earlier this morning by the person chairing the first session, and COVID brain, I had COVID a few weeks ago and things just wander off by themselves. But one of the things that she shared, which I thought was extraordinarily beautiful and vulnerable, was I need to sit with this idea of engaging with conservatives. But then upon reflecting on that, shared how working with someone who she might have perceived as being across the political divide for her actually was the very thing that was necessary to deliver a change that she and they were passionate about. We have more in common than divides us mostly. The other thing that we've learned that was reinforced for me is we need to be brave. We need to stand up, but we're much more powerful when we're brave and we stand up together. And so one of the amazing things about the Congress is that it creates the opportunity for us to do that together. We need to build on agreements and we need to create level conversational playing fields. And we need to ensure that we never overestimate what we can do in the amount of time that we've underestimated we will need. And I guess on the last thing that I'm going to say, and I have spoken really quickly, but I still didn't get through everything I wanted to say. I want to share a story about my dad. When my dad was dying, he was in a kidney ward, and across the bed from him was a person who was on a machine, and the machine was cleaning his kidneys and supporting this person to live. But it had a shudder in it. My father was a diamond driller, and he was looking at the machine, and he was saying every time the machine shudders, it wakes him up. And he's really distressed because he doesn't know what's going on. And my dad said, they just need to put a baffle valve in it and that would solve the problem. It would still function as a machine and it wouldn't wake him up and he would be able to sleep. And I said to my dad, tell them. It's a really great idea, tell them. And my dad said, they wouldn't be interested in what I have to say. And I think the terrible tragedy that we face with climate change and with everything else is that we haven't learned how to listen to people whose opinions we don't value because we see them as being different from ours. But also, if we feel that we're less in an exchange, and I think that was also spoken about this morning, if we feel that as women or as people of color or as trans or binary people or however we see ourselves, that our voice is not valued, then we need the courage to raise it up. And I want you to know that astonishing things do happen, transformative things happen when we build processes that encourage us to listen and speak and weave the solutions from the wisdoms of everyone. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Rhianne. That was an amazing journey through your thoughts around process and many marvelous insights. And I don't want to take up any more time now. I'm going to hand over to Lynn Stevens, another one of our core members, a founding member of the WCC. And she's going to get into getting you all talking and getting into some breakout groups so that we can sort of get your wisdom, basically. Lynn.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Rhianne, for giving us that lovely recap of the morning. And I guess for me, thinking back on the morning, the metaphor of weaving has been really powerful for me. When we started with that metaphor, I thought, oh, yeah, it's nice. But now I see that it's actually fundamental. And I think one of the things that has been really powerful with the Congress so far is that we have really tried to weave together the voices of the women that connect with us. And we do want to reach out to more women so that the cloth that we weave is even more diverse. But I really want you to understand as well that we take what you say really seriously. Every conversation we have online, we listen to and we take the ideas and thoughts and reflections into our work. And that's, if you've been to any of our monthly conversations, that's so. If you've been to any of our members' circles, and as Janet said, the chat from the last event like this was a really fundamental part of our analysis and our work going forward. So this is a really important part of the day. And if you're like me, you're thinking, oh, my God, what a morning. But I want you to just take a minute now just to reflect back on what you've heard in the whole morning and anything that's really struck you. Just so you have a bit of private time before we go into breakout. So breakout groups will be in groups of four. It's an invitation. You don't have to go into breakout if you don't want to, but we'd love if you did, because as I said, you know, all the voices are really important. And you'll have 15 minutes there to talk about what's been important to you from this morning and any questions you might like to ask for any member who's spoken already, or even the comments from the floor. So let's just take a minute now to think for ourselves about what was important or what was confusing or what was challenging from this morning. And then I'll ask Tasea to take us into breakout groups. And if you have any difficulties with breakout, please just put it in the chat and we'll follow up with you. So let's just take a minute now, thinking back over the whole morning. When you're ready, invite you now to go into breakout. And Tasea, if you could set that up. You have 15 minutes.
Welcome back, everyone. Sorry, we're just a bit glued on the technology there for a minute and making sure we had the chat in the right place. And we're just looking at those questions all coming in and getting our heads around those. I hope you had a good discussion. I'm going to pass to Lynn to maybe pick out one or two of the things that are coming in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you very much. I'm going to start with a question from Ali Thwaites, because it picks up a couple of themes that have come up already. And it says, how do we use this wisdom to help people levering change and train people to do consultation better? And I was going to ask you, Rhianne, maybe to comment on that first.
I think one of the easiest ways we can actually start this in terms of is actually learning to train ourselves to be better listeners. So how well do I listen to others? And am I, and I have to say, it's the hair color probably a test. I've been doing this for over 36 years now. And one of the things that strikes me is the same things that I was saying 36 years ago, I'm saying to people now, which could mean I'm very lazy, or it could just mean that in fact, we're not taught how to listen. And it's really hard, particularly even when we love someone, it can be hard to listen to them. It's really hard to listen across the divide. So I think what would be really interesting is to pick someone you loathe as a public figure and spend some time listening to them. What is it they're saying? And I'm not, you know, like, don't do the 10-second sound grab, you know, because that's designed for inflammation. But actually find somebody who's giving a speech that you are opposed to and see what it is they're saying. Or find someone who you disagree with about a whole range of things and practice those deep listening skills. Because often what emerges when we listen to people that we see ourselves as really disagreeing with is that suddenly we realize we have more in common. And one example in relation to that is in relation to conservatives. So for 22 years, I had a partnership with the Foundation for Australian Agricultural Women and Australian Women in Agriculture, many of whom would have been on the conservative side of politics. And I don't know where my politics align anymore because all the political parties are challenging. But what I would say is that probably they don't align more on the conservative side, except I do like the idea of conservation is conservative. But what was astonishing to me was realizing these were extraordinarily good women who had extraordinarily good heart and were women of courage and integrity. And deeply listening to them changed how I saw what was possible. And then I would say that from that, then Kirsten's example of those sponsoring that table that kitchen table conversation with people who see things really differently. And, you know, someone who's vegan, I spend most of my life and along with all my other things being really different to most of the people in the rooms that I'm in. But I think we don't have to wait for it to start next week or next year or after the election. Turn to someone who you see is really different from you and ask them what's important. Learn to ask more, listen more, and ironically, talk less.
Okay. Thank you, Rianne. I'm actually going to turn to Chris now because I understand you need to leave fairly soon. And this is a question from Kirsten. And she says, how do we reconcile contrasting versions of reality about climate change? And it's another reference to deep listening. Where does it fit in? And how do you take the conversation forward in a constructive way? So, Chris, would you like to start on that? Chris Tilacco.
C-R-I-S.
No?
I think we might have, she might have popped out for a minute. She said she was going to be here till one, but would anyone else like to take that question?
Would you like to comment on it, Janet? You know.
Well, yes, my comment on that about the different is to, I mean, I always try to work from some place that there is some right on. I mean, like, if you discount the fact that somebody might be deliberately lying, and I don't really like to get into that in these sorts of conversations but beyond that, then if somebody is saying something, then it's coming from somewhere, some point of truth in them somehow. And so the challenge is to how to keep the conversation or the space safe enough so that you can not just think, oh, well, they're wrong. You know, like, you can take it forward, like, maybe, you know, say, well, what's making you think that? Where did you, you know, like, something to sort of be able to not just assume that you're just telling them that they're wrong, but to sort of go a bit deeper to find out what that reality is that they're bringing in that and see if you can take it forward. Because if we want to have some sort of mediation, some sort of bringing people together, then we have to keep clinging onto the idea that there's going to be truth somewhere on all sides that we can delve into with listening and keeping the space open and keeping the conversation moving forward and not putting up, you know, stops. Yeah.
I might move on to a slightly different tack now, and that is about the need to make the space and time for grieving. And said in the comment is women are good at that. And someone has mentioned the Active Hope course and said that people in the Northern Rivers of New South Wales are finding it very helpful. So I was wondering if, is Sarah there? If Sarah might comment on that need to grieve and women's role in grieving, I guess, about what's happening in the world at the moment.
Yes. Well, you know, when we talk about process so much, and it came up so much in the dialogue, is that process or the way we do things and the way we come to learn to embody these kind of feminized intersectional forms of the political and governance is also deeply pedagogical, in the sense that it's about learning and unlearning and relearning and remembering. And it involves all these different kind of layers of literacies, of languages, of coming, of knowledges, of coming into this way of being, right? And knowing and relating and creating. And that means that there are so many deep radical education traditions. I work with a lot as a radical educator in community, like, yeah, for maybe 30 years as well. And I would say that there are so many of these traditions that can hold space for our grief. Like, we're actually holding a grief circle up in these lands here next month in May, precisely because there is so much grief which has then got layered and is differential with COVID and its impacts and this whole discourse of we're all normal now, it's all back to normal. It's kind of mass gaslighting of the differential impacts of already marginalized folk, women, First Nations, queer, it's horrendous. And just how people are dropping and because they feel it's themselves, right? Because it's internalized and it must be something wrong with me if we're all back to normal now. And so therefore there is a space, there is a real need to stop and to acknowledge the grief with the knowledges we have, right? Whoever's facilitating, and make multiple, and also the rage, I think the righteous rage that's so bloody repressed, particularly for women and feminized folk. We express any of it, are we? Because we're lunatic or hysterical if we do. And so, like, and when you actually channel that and express and give space for that movement and for that flow, then it allows voice. It allows a finding of wisdoms, because there's wisdoms in our pains, right? There's mega wisdoms there when we can move through it and they don't get frozen. And this dropping in that we were also doing in the space. So I think there's it's very pedagogical, this process stuff. It really engages with multiple literacies or multiple languages, multiple knowledges. We have so much, I would imagine, in this space, so much knowledge of folks who could facilitate those kinds of circles. Like, we're doing it anyway. But it's not just emotion as separate from voice and political subjecthood and knowledge. It's really central. Like, it opens up channels for deep wisdom and the kind of wisdoms we know, and for the voice for often women and other folks who have often felt illegitimate and voiceless and without anything to give. So, yeah, I think it's mega. I think it's so important.
Yeah, I'd probably like to add to that, you know, in my role as one of the speakers in this group, that this sort of conversation, when you think about our political system and our politicians and the election that's going on now, it just seems so experienced distant, so distant. The emotional stuff that we're talking about now is so distant from the rhetoric that we know. So I mean, all the time at the Women's Climate Congress, I suppose, and that's why we're talking to women and trying to find out how women think and how can we bring these emotional conversations and this whole experience that we're talking about here, the grief, into our political discourse. And I suppose maybe Lorraine and Alex can comment on that in relation to the Women's Caucus. I mean, I have high hopes for a Women's Caucus. I mean, it's been really central to our work with the Women's Climate Congress. And after the election, we have had some little feedback that would be a really good time to approach women. I mean, I loved the idea that Jo Valentine back in the 1980s had a group of women who met around the members' fountain, were humming, and it wasn't all politicians, but there were politicians in the group. How can we get that sort of vibe and feeling back into our politics, I suppose, is mine.
You're nodding there, Rianne. I wondered if you wanted to comment. There's another question which is really related to this, and that's how do we create psychological safety in all our climate change discussions to move this debate forward? So just put that into the mix.
Yeah. It's Alex here. Can I just quickly make a comment?
Really, Alex Marston.
Yes, sorry.
We're getting the spotlight to you, Alex.
Okay. And you can hear me, which
yes. Yeah. Yes, great.
Oh, there I am. Right. Part of it's just about numbers, isn't it? So, right, I really applaud the work that other women's groups are doing, getting more women politicians there, because we all know how hard it is to make change and speak up and reveal yourself when you're the only woman in a whole group and in a whole powerful group. So hoping for after the election, there will be more women there who are more attuned. Sheer quality of numbers, having them there is a critical thing. The other thing is in terms of the bureaucrats who actually implement stuff and put up policies as well. And I was just saying the little breakout session, have a chat, I'm teaching next week a group of 150 shiny-eyed young graduates who are, you know, meant to be the brightest and the best joining the public service. And I'm teaching about collaboration. What I'm doing is saying you actually have to start understanding and trying to reach out and understand the perspectives of others. That's my core message. And I'll be doing stuff with them for personas and the whole, just to get them to break out and think about the perspectives of others. So, you know, they're, as we've been talking about all morning, there's the different levels of interaction and focus and attack at every level, from me in my study through to the ministers, bureaucrats, through to the communities. And we just have to make sure that we have numbers there to actually do this, I think.
Anyone else like to comment on that?
Actually, can I just comment briefly, Lynn? I think it will be really interesting to see what happens in the election if there are a number of these independent women who succeed in their candidature. We know that Helen Haynes operates really, really differently, in that apparently she, first of all, she consults very closely with her community. Maybe if there's anyone from her electorate here today, maybe you could make a comment in the chat. Apparently she takes her instructions from the community. She will sometimes send community members along to parliamentary meetings. and when challenged on that, she said, well, they know what my position is. So that sounds like quite a radical approach, but certainly it will be interesting to see what new mindsets the independents may bring to the parliament.
You
want to
come away?
I think we're just about at the end of our time. But I notice in the chat that people are sharing resources, so please keep doing that. There's quite a bit there on Active Hope training and other resources that are of interest to us from this conversation. But before we close off, I wanted to ask any of the panels if there's any comment they'd like to make in closing. Any member?
Can I?
Yes, Rian?
So one of the things that I wanted to talk about in my presentation, but I didn't have enough time, was the example of coronial reform. So in 2010, three mothers lost sons, and as a result, in quite tragic circumstances, and as a result of that, each of them went through separately a coronial process. They found that coronial process totally demoralizing, and it was a terrible process. One of them actually had to fight to have a coronial process, and her son, the recommendations from that have actually changed and saved lives. But initially she was denied a coronial process. For 7 years I've worked with them, supporting them to actually negotiate with the government. And one of the things that they've achieved is legislative change. They've also achieved a dedicated coroner now for the first time in the ACT. None of the politicians have changed. what has actually changed is that they built coalitions. So they built a coalition with the union movement, they built a coalition with the Victims of Crime Commission, with the Human Rights Commission, to build a totally different process. And one of the things that has emerged from that totally different process is that the government has committed a budget of around $250,000 to facilitate a restorative reform process, which for the first time actually sees government participating, not driving that process, not in charge of that process, but as a stakeholder on an equal level with every other stakeholder around that table. It also includes the courts, the police, and a whole lot of other participants. They're on an equal playing field with these advocates who have been working together. And one of the things that's been extraordinarily powerful is that the advocates have actually worked with the government and the Human Rights Commission to develop the terms of reference for the person or persons who will facilitate the process. So I have great hopes that we will get exciting, extraordinary, innovative people elected in the next election. I always hope that. But if we have the same, whoever we have, if we don't have different systems, we will not have different results. And part of what we need to do is empower the community to be part of designing processes. And in fact, as a result of that, that's why we get differences. So I really just want to emphasize so clearly, and that what I would say for those advocates, they were not deeply listened to along the way at any point, or they certainly didn't feel that. But as a result of building this process, they have been and they will be, and that will change things for everyone in this community and beyond. And that's the model for dealing with climate change as well. Thank you.
I think in a previous conversation that we had with Rhianne, and it has come out this morning, I'll just run through, you mentioned, Rhianne, a number of sort of pillars really for this sort of work. One was building awareness. I think we've been doing that this morning wonderfully, which I hope everyone will take something away. Another thing was careful building of coalitions, and that is what you've just mentioned there as well. And I think that's what we're trying to do in the WCC, and we'd love everyone to help us. Another thing is to have a few champions along the way, and a broad call from the community, which is also what we're building here too, I think, and that's what you've just been talking about. So yeah, let's all go away and work on those things, eh?
that's a nice place to finish. But just quickly, I wanted to offer Lorraine a chance to make any comment that she wanted to before we finish off. You there, Lorraine?
Thank you, Lynn. That's very kind. And I think all I can offer, I think, is you know, that sense of rightness as we all come together to talk about how this is possible, what are the sort of changes, and how it's not just about asking our politicians to change, it's asking us to change, and how we can come together to create the coalitions and the webs and the weavings that will actually help us wrap a better world around us all.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And thank you everyone who has put questions and comments into the chat. Please keep doing it. Share resources and just that chat is really precious to us. So please use it. So, and it's time now for...
Thank you, Lynn. And thank you again to all of our participants online and for our guests this morning, our guest conversationalists is what we really like to call them. And we're now going to take a break for lunch, and we want to start again at 1:45, and we've got a bit of a change of pace this afternoon, and we do need the time, so hopefully you can come back at 1:45. I'm just going to ask Johanna again, we'll put up some of Hillary's pictures just for you to, you know, wind down as you move away from your screens. Go away and have some lovely lunch. Over the lunch break, I might also share my screen and show you some of the election work that we've been doing at the WCC, our key messages. We are in the middle of an election campaign. We need to sort of be a bit charged up about that. And we'll see you back here at 1:45. Thank you very much, everyone.